A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about the Aetherius Society ever since we did that episode on weirdly specific cults, and he's come back with a whole list of questions. He wants to know who founded it, and how it got started, where the Holy Mountains are, and why those specific peaks, what a pilgrimage actually involves, the mechanics of charging a mountain, current follower counts and geography, memorable ceremonies or prophecies, and what makes this group stand out even among other new religious movements. That's a lot of ground.
And it's ground worth covering because the Aetherius Society is one of those things where the more you learn, the more it all fits together in its own strange way. It's not just a random collection of weird ideas. There's a logic to it.
That's the part that gets me. You hear UFO religion, where mountains are spiritual batteries, and you think someone threw darts at a board of concepts. But then you actually look at it, and it's built. There's a structure.
Founded in 1955 by a man named George King. He was a London taxi driver before all this, and a practicing spiritualist medium. Born in 1919 in Shropshire. And on May 8, 1955, at his home in London, he claimed he was contacted by an extraterrestrial intelligence called Aetherius.
A taxi driver in London receives a cosmic phone call and builds an entire religion out of it. That's either the most human thing I've ever heard, or the least.
Both, honestly. King was told he'd become what the society calls the primary terrestrial mental channel for the cosmic masters. That's the title, not just a channel, the primary one, for the whole planet.
I appreciate the specificity. If you're going to claim to be the voice of space beings, don't be vague about your job description.
And the cosmic masters, in their theology, are advanced beings from other planets who are guiding humanity through spiritual evolution. They include figures like Jesus, Buddha, and Krishna, reinterpreted as extraterrestrial beings who have been helping Earth along for millennia. King was just the latest conduit.
So, it's not a clean break from existing religion. It's a remix. Take the figures people already revere, give them spaceships, and suddenly you've got continuity instead of rupture.
And that's part of why it works as a belief system. You don't have to abandon everything you grew up with, you just upgrade the cosmology. Now, the core practice, and this is where Daniel's questions really land, is something called spiritual energy transmission. The idea is that through intense prayer and meditation, often lasting hours, practitioners accumulate cosmic energy and then radiate it outward for the benefit of humanity.
And the mountains are where this happens.
The mountains are the anchors. Think of them as spiritual capacitors. They store the energy. King claimed the cosmic masters directed him to specific peaks around the world because those mountains have unique spiritual properties. They're natural conductors.
So the mountain isn't just a nice backdrop for meditation. It's a piece of infrastructure.
Right. And the first one to be charged was Holdstone Down in Devon, England in 1958. That's 3 years after the founding. King took a group there, performed the first charging ritual, and that mountain became the template for everything that followed.
Holdstone Down. That's not exactly Everest. It's a hill in Devon.
About 350 meters. You can walk up it in an afternoon. But in the society's cosmology, it's one of the most spiritually significant points on the planet. The cosmic masters identified it, King channeled the instructions, and now it's a holy mountain. Castle Peak in California is another major one. There are 19 holy mountains in total, spread across multiple continents.
19. That's a specific number. Why 19?
That's what the cosmic masters designated. I don't know that there's a deeper numerological explanation in their published materials, but 19 mountains, each chosen because it sits on what they believe is a spiritually significant node. They're not random. The locations were revealed through channeling over a period of years.
So King had his contact in 55. He charges the first mountain in 58, and then over time the map fills in as the masters give him more coordinates. It's like a cosmic scavenger hunt.
That's not a bad way to put it. And here's the thing about the charging mechanism itself. It's not a one-time event. These mountains are recharged through repeated pilgrimages. The energy isn't permanent. It needs to be replenished.
That's the misconception Daniel was probably brushing up against. You hear charged mountain, and you think someone waved a wand over it in 1958, and now it's done. But it's ongoing maintenance.
Ongoing, and in some cases, coordinated globally. The Society runs what they call operations. These are large-scale synchronized prayer events where members around the world meditate at the same time to generate maximum spiritual energy. The most famous is Operation Prayer Power, which involved thousands of participants worldwide.
Thousands? That's more than I'd have guessed.
The Society claims thousands of members globally, with significant branches in the UK, the US, and Australia. Exact numbers are hard to verify. They're a registered charity in the UK. They have a physical headquarters in London and a retreat center in California, but they're not exactly publishing membership rolls.
And they're not growing the way, say, Scientology did. They've stayed small.
Small but persistent. And that's actually interesting in itself. Most new religious movements flare up and die out within a generation. The Aetherius Society has been around for over 70 years now. King died in 1997, and the movement didn't collapse.
That's the question that sticks with me. What happens to a channeled religion when the channel is gone? If your entire theology rests on one guy being the primary terrestrial mental channel, and then he dies, how do you keep the signal going?
They've managed it. King's wife, and later other senior members, took over leadership. The Society continues to publish, continues to hold pilgrimages, continues to charge the mountains. They've institutionalized the practices enough that the founder's absence doesn't break the system.
Which suggests the practices themselves, the rituals, the community, the shared experience of pilgrimage. Those are doing the real work of holding the movement together. The theology is the frame, but the practice is the substance.
And the practice is genuinely demanding. A pilgrimage isn't just showing up at a mountain and feeling the vibes. Participants gather at dawn, often, and engage in structured prayer sessions using specific prayer formulas and mantras published by the Society. You're expected to maintain a focused, reverent mindset throughout. Some of these sessions go for hours.
So if I show up at Holdstone Down on pilgrimage day, what am I actually doing? Walk me through it.
You'd arrive early, probably before sunrise. There's a specific protocol for approaching the charged area of the mountain. You'd join a group of fellow members, and a designated leader would guide the session. You'd recite the prescribed prayers, which are designed to draw in cosmic energy and then radiate it outward. The meditation isn't passive, it's directed. You're visualizing energy flowing through you into the mountain and then out into the world.
And the energy is for everyone? Specific causes?
The framing is altruistic. You're doing spiritual work on behalf of humanity. The Society teaches something called karma yoga, the idea that spiritual merit can be earned on behalf of others. So when you're up there praying at dawn, you're not doing it for your own enlightenment, you're doing it for the planet.
That's a clever bit of theology. It transforms what could be a self-centered practice into a moral obligation. You're not meditating for you. You're meditating because the world needs you to.
And it creates a sense of purpose that's hard to match in a more conventional religious setting. You're not just attending a service, you're part of a cosmic operation to save humanity.
Which brings us to the prophecies and the more dramatic claims. Daniel asked about memorable incidents.
The one that stands out is the Silence Group and the Kaishtim disaster. In 1957, there was a nuclear accident at a plutonium production facility in the Soviet Union near a town called Kaishtim. It was one of the worst nuclear disasters before Chernobyl, and the Soviets kept it secret for decades. The Aetherius Society claims that a secret group of their meditators, the Silence Group, worked to neutralize the spiritual fallout from that disaster.
Spiritual fallout. Not radiation. The spiritual consequences of a nuclear accident.
Right. In their cosmology, nuclear explosions and accidents don't just release radiation, they release negative spiritual energy that harms the planet on a deeper level. The Silence Group allegedly directed concentrated prayer at Kaishtim to counteract that harm.
So while the Soviets were covering up the physical disaster, a group of meditators in England and America were fighting the spiritual battle. That's an incredible narrative. It blends Cold War anxiety with cosmic warfare.
And it's unfalsifiable, which is the point. You can't prove they didn't neutralize spiritual fallout, but for a believer, it's a powerful story. Your small group, doing quiet prayer work, is literally saving the world from forces that most people don't even know exist.
That's the engine of a lot of new religious movements. The hidden battle, the secret knowledge, the sense that you're one of the few people who understands what's really going on.
King also made broader prophecies. He spoke about the coming New Age, about the role of the Cosmic Masters in averting nuclear catastrophe during the Cold War. The Society claims that several potential disasters were averted through concentrated prayer operations. Again, unfalsifiable, but internally consistent.
What's the strangest specific belief you've come across? The thing that makes you stop and say, okay, that's a detail someone had to invent.
The one that gets me is the classification system for the Cosmic Masters. They're not just space beings. There's a hierarchy. Aetherius is one specific entity. There's also someone called the Master Jesus, the Master Buddha. They have titles. They have roles. It's a whole organizational chart for the cosmos.
An old chart for enlightened space beings. That's the part where you can see the taxi driver's mind at work. A London cabbie would think in terms of structure and rank. You don't just have vague spiritual entities. You have a chain of command.
And Earth, in their teaching, is described as a classroom. We're here to learn. The Cosmic Masters are the teachers. The mountains are, I don't know, the lab equipment.
The spiritual Bunsen burners.
That's it, exactly. And the prayer operations are the experiments. You're running a procedure to generate a measurable spiritual effect.
Measurable in what sense? Do they claim to detect the energy?
Not in any empirical way, no. There's no instrument that reads spiritual energy levels. The evidence is, well, the fact that the world hasn't ended. The fact that disasters were averted. The internal logic is that if the prayer operation stopped, things would get worse. So the continued existence of civilization is, in a sense, the proof.
Which is a perfect closed loop. You can't test it, you can't disprove it, and any apparent absence of effect just means the work is succeeding.
And that's not unique to the Aetherius Society. A lot of religious practices work that way. Prayer for rain. If it rains, the prayer worked. If it doesn't, it wasn't the right time, or you didn't pray hard enough, or God has other plans. The structure is the same.
What about the current state of things? Daniel asked about follower counts and geography.
The main centers are the UK, the US, and Australia. The London headquarters is still active. They have a retreat center in California near Castle Peak. They publish a journal. They hold regular events. The membership is probably in the low thousands globally. It's not a mass movement, and it probably never will be.
Does it need to be? If your theology is about a small group of dedicated practitioners doing spiritual work on behalf of everyone else, growth might not even be the goal. You don't need millions of people charging mountains. You need a committed core.
The Karma Yoga framework means that a few can do the work for the many. Scaling up might actually dilute the practice. If everyone's a cosmic channel, nobody is.
And the mountains themselves, the 19 holy mountains, are they all publicly accessible? Can I just go to Holdstone Down and hike up?
Most of them are on public land or accessible by public footpaths. Holdstone Down is in an area of outstanding natural beauty in Devon. You can walk up it. The Society doesn't own the mountains. They just use them.
So the mountain is just sitting there, being a hill in Devon. And twice a year, a group of people shows up at dawn to charge it with cosmic energy. And then they go home. And to everyone else, it's just a nice place for a walk.
That juxtaposition is part of what makes the whole thing so fascinating. The mundane and the cosmic sitting right next to each other. You're eating a sandwich on a rock where someone believes they're saving the world through directed prayer.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. The prayer formulas. Are these published? Can you read them?
Yes. The Society publishes books of prayers and mantras. They're specific invocations, often calling on the Cosmic Masters by name, directing energy in particular ways. Some of them are quite long. They're not improvised. You don't show up and freestyle your cosmic energy work. You follow the script.
So there's a liturgy. A formal, written liturgy for charging mountains with alien spiritual energy.
And that's what I mean about internal consistency. Once you accept the founding premise that George King was contacted by Aetherius and appointed the primary terrestrial mental channel, everything else follows. Of course there's a liturgy. Of course there are specific prayers. Of course there's a hierarchy of cosmic masters and a schedule of operations. These are the things a religion has. It is. But that's true of every religion. The founding premise of Christianity is that a man rose from the dead. The founding premise of Islam is that an angel dictated a book to a merchant in a cave. The Aetherius Society's premise is weirder to modern ears, because it involves spaceships instead of angels, but structurally it's the same move.
Spaceships feel more specific than angels. Angels are vague. Aetherius is a named entity from a specific contact event on a specific date.
May 8, 1955. And that specificity might actually make it harder for the movement to grow. Angels can be anything to anyone. Aetherius is Aetherius. You're either on board with that particular channeled entity or you're not.
The specificity is the barrier to entry, and also the thing that makes it interesting. Generic spirituality is boring. 19 holy mountains and a cosmic org chart is a story.
And the story has survived its author. King died in 97. The society is still running operations. People are still climbing Holdstone down at dawn.
Do we know how the leadership transition worked? Was there a succession plan, or did it just kind of continue?
King had designated successors within the organization, and his wife played a significant role after his death. The society had already built enough institutional structure, the publications, the branches, the ritual calendar, that it could function without the founding channel. They don't claim a new primary terrestrial mental channel. They work with the material King left behind.
So the revelation is closed. The canon is fixed. That's another thing that makes it look more like an established religion and less like a cult of personality.
Right. The charismatic founder phase ended in 1997. What's left is the institution, and institutions can persist for a long time on ritual and community alone.
I keep thinking about those 19 mountains. If you're a member, you've got this map of sacred sites scattered across the planet. It gives you a geography of meaning. Most of us just see hills and rocks. You see a network of spiritual infrastructure.
You can visit them. There's a pilgrimage route, effectively. You could spend years traveling to all 19 holy mountains, participating in charging operations at each one. That's a life project, a purpose.
That's not nothing. In a world where a lot of people feel disconnected and purposeless, here's a map with 19 dots on it, and a reason to visit each one.
A community waiting at each dot. You're not doing it alone. You're joining a group of people who share your cosmology, your practices, your sense of mission. That's powerful, regardless of what you think about the underlying claims.
What about the weirder edges? Daniel asked about the most unexpectedly specific beliefs. He mentioned the org chart. What else?
There's a whole thing about flying saucers. The society teaches that the cosmic masters travel in flying saucers, and that some of these craft have been seen and photographed. King claimed to have had physical encounters with these beings, not just channeled communications.
Physical encounters? As in, they landed?
He described being taken aboard spacecraft on multiple occasions. These are close encounters of the third kind, in the standard UFO terminology, face-to-face with the beings.
This is in the published literature.
It's in the books. King wrote extensively about his experiences. The society sells these books. You can buy them.
A London taxi driver writing about his trips aboard flying saucers to meet Jesus and Buddha, who are actually space beings, and then going to Devon to charge a hill with cosmic energy. And 70 years later, people are still doing it.
If you met one of those people on a pilgrimage, they wouldn't be wild-eyed or unhinged. They'd be normal, earnest, probably quite pleasant. They'd explain the theology clearly and invite you to join a prayer session.
That's the part that messes with people's heads. The gap between the belief and the believer. You expect the belief to produce a certain kind of person, and then you meet them and they're just someone's grandmother who spends her weekends meditating on a hill.
Clinical training teaches you that. The patient's internal reality can be completely disconnected from observable reality, but they're still a person, still coherent, still capable of functioning in the world. The belief system is a container. It holds their experience together.
This particular container has held together for 7 decades. That's longer than a lot of marriages.
Longer than a lot of countries.
All right. So we've got the founder, the founding moment, the mountains, the charging mechanism, the pilgrimages, the operations, the silence group, the org chart of space beings, the flying saucers. What haven't we covered?
Daniel asked about what makes it stand out among new religious movements. I think it's the combination of extreme specificity and genuine institutional staying power. Most groups this weird burn out in a generation. This one built an organization that outlived its prophet.
The specificity is the moat. If you're just another meditation group with vague spiritual language, you blend in. If you've got 19 holy mountains and a primary terrestrial mental channel, you're distinct. People who join know exactly what they're joining.
People who leave know exactly what they're leaving. There's no ambiguity.
I've been listening, and I want to push back on something you've both been building toward. This idea that the Aetherius Society is internally consistent and therefore worth taking seriously as a belief system. I think calling it coherent is a category error.
Say more.
The belief system is so flexible that it can absorb any contradiction without ever being falsifiable. The charging mechanism has no observable effect that couldn't be attributed to placebo or group psychology. The claims about averting disasters are structured so that nothing counts as evidence against them. If the disaster doesn't happen, the prayer worked. If it does happen, the negative forces were too strong, or the prayer wasn't intense enough, or the timing was off. That's not coherence. That's a system designed to be immune to reality.
I don't disagree that it's unfalsifiable, but that's true of a lot of religious claims. Intercessory prayer in any tradition has the same structure.
Sure, but you're not just saying it's a religion. You're saying it's internally consistent in a way that makes it worth studying on its own terms, and I think that gives it more credit than it deserves. King's prophecies were vague enough to be reinterpreted after the fact. The 19 mountains were revealed gradually, which means they could be adjusted as needed. The whole thing has the structure of a story that's being made up as it goes along, with enough wiggle room built in to absorb any challenge.
I push back on the made-up-as-it-goes-along part. That's true of every religion in its founding phase. The question isn't whether the claims are true. The question is whether the system has an internal logic that holds together for the people inside it.
But internal logic that's disconnected from any external check isn't logic. It's narrative. And studying the narrative structure of a delusion isn't the same as respecting it.
I don't think we're respecting it in the sense of endorsing it. We're describing how it works. The fact that it's unfalsifiable is part of what makes it interesting. Most human meaning, making systems are unfalsifiable. Love, justice, beauty. You can't run a controlled experiment on any of them.
Love and justice don't claim that a specific hill in Devon stores cosmic energy that was put there by a space being named Aetherius.
No, but they do make claims that can't be verified. That's my point. The Aetherius Society is just more explicit about it. The unfalsifiability is out in the open. It's almost honest.
Honest is a strange word for a system built on claims about flying saucers and spiritual capacitors.
I'll concede this much. The internal coherence we're describing is internal. It's not empirical. It doesn't map onto anything you can measure. But that's precisely what makes it useful as a case study. It shows how human beings construct meaning even in the complete absence of external validation. The structure is the point.
I suppose the structure is worth looking at. I just wouldn't confuse structure with substance.
I don't think we are, but I take your point. The line between coherent belief system and well-organized fiction is thinner than we've been making it sound.
For the people on the inside, that line doesn't matter. The experience is real. The community is real. The dawn on Holdstone Down is real. Whether the cosmic energy is real is almost beside the point.
Which is either the most generous or the most damning thing you can say about a religion? I'm not sure which.
Probably both. That's usually how it works.
Where does a movement like this go? King's been dead for nearly 30 years. The UFO topic is having a mainstream moment. Does that help them or hurt them?
It's a double-edged thing. On one hand, more people are open to the idea that we're not alone in the universe. That lowers the barrier to entry for a group like this. On the other hand, if UFOs become mundane, if they're just drones or atmospheric phenomena or whatever the Pentagon is releasing footage of this week, then the mystery drains out. And the Aetherius Society runs on mystery.
The mainstreaming of the weird kills the weird.
Potentially. But I think groups like this are resilient precisely because they're not dependent on public opinion. They've got their 19 mountains, they've got their ritual calendar, they've got a core community that shows up at dawn. They don't need to be popular, they just need to keep going.
The Aetherius Society is a reminder that the line between religion and cult is often just a matter of time and numbers. Give it another 100 years and a few 100,000 more members, and it's just a religion. With some unusual architectural preferences.
Mountain-shaped architecture.
19 of them. spread across the planet, charged and recharged, waiting for the next operation.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping us honest.
If you want to dig deeper into any of the groups we've covered, the show notes are at myweirdprompts.com. And if you've got a question that's been keeping you up at night, send it to show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.